Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Radio Lawyers News at 9. It is Wednesday, October 21, and I'm your anchor, Ananya. Our show conveys you the week's local, national, and worldwide news every Wednesday of the week. We are covering all from local issues here in KW to international issues around the world. Let's start over with the most significant news, which is a spike in COVID-19 cases in the Waterloo region. The area sees an increase of 21 new COVID cases on Saturday. This brings the new total up to 1975 for the region since March. According to 570 News reports, there are 1749 resolved cases, which is nearly 88.5%, 120 related deaths in the region, and it stays unchanged since August 21, and 6 cases are hospitalized as of Saturday. Alongside, an outbreak of COVID-19 cases at Wilfrid Laurier University has led to 9 new positive cases, bringing the campus total to 24 confirmed cases in the past 30 days. While this total is made up of both students and residents and others on campus. The initial outbreak at the school was declared on October 13th. Well, we have come a long way since the pandemic started. We all should know about the precautions required to prevent the virus. Therefore, I will not dive into it. Instead, wish you all to stay safe and conscious about it. Staying sane and calm is very important during this unavoidable situation. There are some ways through which we can stay healthy mentally and physically, because staying fit in both is very crucial. The mind is a muscle, and it needs to rest, refill, build, and renew, just like the body. Not only reactively when we have a challenge. And the truth is, both our physical and mental health are intertwined. Our mental effects are physical, and our physical effects are mental. According to therapists, exercising on a daily basis can help overcome anxiety. Using your breath as your partner to help you calm, relax, balance, and find peace and ease. Do not underestimate your breath. It is connected to your every emotion. Moving on from COVID news to general public and crime news. Waterloo region had a gunshot fired at a house early Friday. The gunshots alarmed distinct neighborhoods early Friday morning with loud popping sounds awakening residents, leaving one car punctured with bullet holes in a Kitchener driveway. Gratefully, nobody was hurt in the shootings. According to 570 News, within a few minutes, Waterloo Regional Police received a 911 call from someone who said that their Waterloo house had been shot at several times. Right after, police noticed a Honda silver-tinted window car fleeing around the area, and they pursued it around Fisher Hallman Road and McGarry Drive in the Forest Heights area. But police had to ditch them and end the pursuit at Bleams Road. Leaving everybody in shock, the shooting continued, and less than an hour later, a similar 911 call rang in from someone saying their house had been fired at. Shockingly, this time it was in Kitchener, in a Dunes suburb near Highway 401 on Apple Ridge Drive. Investigators are looking in if these two incidents are connected by any means. A day later, Waterloo Regional Police investigated a fatal shooting in the South Cambridge area that occurred at night on October 17th. Police said one 19-year-old man is deceased and there will be a large number of police presence in the area throughout. Police tweeted that they had arrested a male in connection with the case within roughly 24 hours of the crime. It is untold if the charges have been laid against the suspect. More information on this crime will be released later on. Moving on, students won the honor for their scholastic and extracurricular accomplishments. The Caribbean Canadian Association of Waterloo Region and the Waterloo Region Section of the Congress of Black Women of Canada hand out awards of excellence every year to meriting youngsters in the region. The current year's function was dropped because of COVID-19. However, a portion of the champs were featured on CBC's The Morning Version with Craig Norris. The three scholarship winners that were recognized by CBC are Doug Mavet, Vorkyu, Gabriel George, and Daniel Clark. Vorkyu studies architectural engineering at the University of Waterloo. Gabriel George and Daniel Clark are students at University of Waterloo as well. Daniel Clark is a fourth year accounting student at the university, whereas Gabriel George is a first year student at the university. Now we move on to the national news of the week.
Good morning, Laurier. This is Rajni bringing you local news at 9. On the battle for Indigenous fishing rights in eastern Canada. Indigenous fishermen in Nova Scotia are still battling for their fishing rights after over 250 years of ignored treaties and broken agreements. Tensions are rising and the issue came to a head this past week when two Indigenous fishermen were trapped in a lobster-holding area by an angry mob of non-Indigenous fishermen. Their lobsters, valued at over $40,000, were also destroyed by the assailants in the name of conservation, while the RCMP did little to intervene in the situation. The Mi'kmaq believe that they should have the right to fish as per their constitutional rights under the Peace and Friendship Treaty. However, the non-Indigenous fishers argue that it is unfair and illegal for the Mi'kmaq fishers to catch lobster in the off-season. Each group believes they are in the right, but to get to the bottom of this issue, we must first find out where it began. Canada is the largest exporter of lobster in the world, with half the profits of this $1.04 billion industry coming from Nova Scotia. The majority of this industry has long since been dominated by French and British settlers for many generations and is a major part of the Nova Scotian economy. Recently, though, settler fishermen have complained about smaller yields, especially from 2016 to 2018, where yields decreased by almost 10%. Worst of all, there doesn't seem to be any clear reason for this decline. This issue only compounds their resentment toward Indigenous fishers from the Spiganacadi First Nation, which recently launched its own fishery. Originally intended as a means of gathering data to implement sustainable practices for the future, this Indigenous fishery launched in September 2020, with 11 licenses issued, each permitted to set up to 50 traps. The only problem was, this fishery launched in the off-season for lobster, which created an uproar among the settler fishers. The timing of the launch made the Mi'kmaq fishers easy scapegoats for fishermen who were worried about the future of their industry, especially in the face of a global pandemic, which has reduced exports to China, one of the biggest consumers. These fishers have concerns because Mi'kmaq fishermen do not have quotas or caps on how many traps they can set or a specific season when they can fish. Lobster is a highly lucrative and highly regulated product and can be the only significant source of income for independent inshore fishers. They have cause for worry, as loss of lobster or decreased yields could spell ruin, especially in the aftermath of the collapse of the cod fishery due to corporate offshore overfishing. However, research from the University of Maine Marine Sciences Department suggests that there is no real conservational gain to be had from restricting lobster fishing during molting season. Robert Stenek, professor of oceanography, says that the only issue would be the mortality of softer-shelled lobsters during transportation, but this would be less relevant if the lobster were only for local consumption. Additionally, he agrees that the minute number of Indigenous lobster traps authorized by the fishery would have a negligible impact on the overall lobster population, especially in comparison to the numbers allowed for non-Indigenous commercial fisheries, which have 979 licenses permitted 350 to 400 traps each. This number is just a drop in the bucket. The bigger issue at play here, though, is the violation of the Peace and Friendship Treaty of 1752, which granted free access to Mi'kmaq people to hunt, fish, and establish trade on their ancestral lands. This treaty had been ignored for years by the Canadian government, until the 1999 Marshall decision, which granted Mi'kmaq fishers the right to fish to maintain a modest livelihood. Despite the treaty, they still needed permits to fish, which led to the arrest and fine of many indigenous fishers who were technically within their rights to fish, according to the treaty. One such fisherman was Donald Marshall Jr., who is also Chief Michael Sack's father. He was challenged by an officer of the Department of Fisheries to present his fishing license. When he replied that he had the treaty on his side, the officer replied, "Everyone needs a license to fish." His decision to challenge the officer led to a 6-year court battle that culminated in the landmark Marshall decision. This was 21 years ago. The courts agreed that the Mi'kmaq have the right to fish and sell a sufficient amount to earn a moderate livelihood as per the Treaty of 1752. The issue with this definition is how vastly the perception of a modest livelihood varies from that time to the present. When the treaty was originally established, a modest living was understood as more than simply feeding oneself and one's immediate family. It would have been considered as an income suitable enough to always have a steady flow of resources for oneself, more than just a hand-to-mouth existence. Today, though, this definition is being taken as fishing enough to subsist and have just enough for one's family. Furthermore, the government chose to simply sign separate agreements with individual First Nations instead of recognizing the overarching treaty. Aside from these agreements being ambiguously worded, for example, the modest living stipulated was not given hard boundaries or cap amounts, they were rarely ever upheld by local or federal authorities. It is therefore difficult for indigenous fishers to call upon authorities like the police or the RCMP when they are faced with violence because of consistent violation of their land and sea rights in the past. Additionally, where the issue of conservation arises, it seems hypocritical for indigenous fishermen to be restricted to less fishing in the name of conservation, as indigenous cultural practices prioritize sustainability and respect for nature. The Marshall ruling also sparked similar violence toward indigenous fishers in Burnt Church, who laid traps in the water days after the ruling, only to have them seized by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. The same officials drove the Mi'kmaq off the water and went to regional chiefs to try and stave off violence. Following that incident, the department has spent over $500 million to buy commercial license and gear for First Nations across Atlantic Canada, which has empowered them and provided new economic opportunities. However, the Mi'kmaq still have to face intimidation from settler fishers. John Paul, a fishing captain from Membertou, was threatened by a North Sydney lobsterman, retrieved a trap with a knife stuck in it, and had his $300,000 boat burned in the wharf the next day. He also reports tampering with equipment and thieving of lobsters as a very common issue. The most important factor at the heart of this issue is the fact that the residents of coastal fishing villages have very little faith in the police's ability to resolve conflict. This leads to the increased prevalence of jungle justice. Perhaps the most shocking example of this is the case of Philippe Bougeot, who was attacked by the fishers who believed him to be the lobster thief and killed at sea in 2013. His body has still not been recovered. Similarly, indigenous fishermen also do not trust the authorities to dispense justice without racial bias. This mistrust is not unfounded, as recent video footage from the scene shows policemen standing around while verbal abuse is being hurled at Mi'kmaq fishers by an angry mob of white fishermen. When they pull aside individuals who get too violent, no attempts are made to disperse the crowd. Indigenous fisherman Jason Marr was trapped for 2 hours in a lobster pond by one such mob before the police responded to his multiple calls for help. According to Marr, their solution was that he should hand over his lobster to the mob to appease the violence. He also claims that the police made no attempt to stop the mob from vandalizing his vehicle. However, the RCMP maintains that they are trying their best in this situation and are collecting evidence from the scenes. In a statement made to Global News, Public Safety Minister Bill Blair said that the RCMP exerted their authority to the best of their ability and had laid charges where appropriate. However, Chief Michael Sack of the Spigenacadie First Nation believes the RCMP did not do enough and that their inaction only enables the mob to engage in further violence. At this point, he is calling for military interventions to put a stop to the violence once and for all.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the global edition of Radio Laurier News at 9. My name is Jeffrey, and welcome to the show. Today, we will be talking about a number of topics that have come up across the world in the last week, starting off with some positive news. On Saturday, Jacinda Ardern and the Labour Party of New Zealand won a second term in office. It has been a historic week for New Zealanders, who are currently witnessing one of the most lopsided election victories in recent memory. Ardern and the Labour Party won with a decisive victory, winning 64 of the 120 seats this past Saturday, nearly 50% of the vote, compared to the Labour Party's biggest opposition, the Conservative National Party, who only won 27% of the vote. With this majority win, the Labour Party becomes the first in 24 years to win an election outright. Ardern, who is globally renowned for her policies and her party's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, was the clear choice for most New Zealanders. Her charisma, compassion, and decisiveness are just some of her best qualities as a leader. It is without question Ardern has handled the coronavirus pandemic better than most world leaders, as there is currently no community spread of COVID in New Zealand, a country of nearly 5 million people. In late March, with only a light amount of cases, Ardern and her team put the country into a strict lockdown, shut down the borders in a hard-nosed attempt to battle the virus. The results have been astounding. Ardern's victory has been seen by many as an inspiring result, as she has paved the way for being an effective and compassionate world leader. Some highlights from her first term in office include her brilliant handling of the Christchurch mosque shooting of 2019, where 51 people were tragically killed. Ardern was extremely compassionate with the Muslim community after this tragic incident and swiftly banned most semi-automatic rifles in New Zealand. Her work as a leader resulted in her being discussed for the Nobel Peace Prize. Other notable highs that Ardern had in her first term include her focus on climate change policy, as she banned plastic bags in New Zealand and pushed for the implementation of a zero carbon bill. Ardern presented a plan that would tax farmers for the carbon emissions by 2025 or earlier if the country is not meeting its emission reduction goals. The zero carbon bill implemented by Ardern would require all greenhouse gases except methane from animals to be reduced to zero by 2050. Methane emissions would be reduced by 10% by 2030 and between about one quarter and one half by 2050. Ardern has made numerous speeches at the United Nations and the Pacific Island Forum, calling for global action on climate change. With a majority win, Jacinda Ardern will have full availability to implement more ambitious policies, a privilege that she did not have in her first term. Congratulations to one of the most respectable world leaders there is today. Congratulations, Jacinda. In other world news, tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets in Bangkok and across Thailand to protest a government ban on political gatherings of five or more people. The ban comes after several months of protests against the country's Prime Minister, Prayuth Chan-o-cha, a former military ruler, and the monarch of Thailand, King Maha Vajiralongkorn. Protests began after many started calling for the resignation of the country's Prime Minister, who took power during a 2014 coup. The protesters' recent criticism of the king and their want for royal reform is a delicate topic in Thailand, where public criticism of the monarchy is punishable with long prison sentences. On Friday, October 16th, police were documented using water cannons to disperse the crowds of protesters, despite the fact that many of the activists were young children. Police further attempted to dismantle the protest by shutting down Bangkok's public transit system. This backfired as protesters continued to hold localized demonstrations across the city. The monarchy has made no comment on the protest, but the king has said Thailand needs people who love its country and its monarchy. In a similar story coming out of Lagos, Nigeria, thousands of protesters gathered on the streets of the country's capital to protest police brutality. The protests sparked over anger with the police's infamous anti-robbery squad, also known as SARS, which has forced the government to dismantle the unit last week. The SARS squad has been accused of many abuses, including targeting young people who look well-dressed, shaking them down for money, torturing, abusing, and even killing those who resist. The crowds continue to grow despite promises to implement a string of reforms dealing with police brutality from the authorities. The protesters, who are mostly young people, demand more changes from the government after 10 people were killed by police during the demonstrations. Nigerian women have played a pivotal role in organizing and fundraising the protests. A newly founded woman-led NGO known as the Feminist Coalition has crowdfunded over 37 million naira in support of the protests. Members of the group have also done extraordinary work in the release of detained protesters and have helped those still under arrest get access to legal counsel. Amazing work by some amazing women. Shout out to them. In other news, COVID cases continue to soar worldwide as Friday, October 16th marked the highest daily case number with over 400,000 corona cases reported. Europe has become the epicenter of the pandemic, reporting more than 140,000 cases a day over the past week. According to a Reuters analysis, of every 100 COVID infections reported around the world, 34 have been coming from European nations. There has been 11 arrests made in France after a college teacher was beheaded in the street in what is believed to be an act of terrorism. The attack came 10 days after Samuel Paty, a teacher at Dubois de Lune, showed controversial images of the Prophet Muhammad to his students. The subject, an 18-year-old man, was killed by police shortly after the murder took place. This man has been described by police as being of Russian descent from the Chechnya region. Mr. Paty had been the target of threats after he showed the images of Prophet Muhammad during a class about freedom of speech. Of the 11 arrested, 4 people were close relatives of the suspect and were arrested shortly after the murder took place. Thousands of French citizens took to the streets over the weekend to march in solidarity, mourning the tragic incident and expressing outrage that such a brutal murder could take place. Demonstrators gathered in large numbers across Paris, Lyon, Toulouse, Marseille, and several other large French cities. Thousands of mostly young women marched on Saturday in several major cities in the U.S., including Washington, D.C., in opposition to the possible re-election of current American President Donald J. Trump. The event's organizer, Rachel O'Leary Carmona, urged protesters to wear masks in an attempt to prevent further spread of the virus. O'Leary Carmona stated that his presidency, when talking about Trump, started with women marching and is going to end with women voting. Powerful words. Many protesters hope to push for the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat to be filled before Election Day in November. More than 22 million Americans have turned in their ballots for early voting as of Friday, October 16th, more than triple the amount from the 2016 election. This new surge in early voting, many believe, is due to complications from the coronavirus pandemic, as many people would be unable to cast their ballot on the actual election. States such as Texas and Ohio have seen a huge increase in potential mail-in voters, a topic that has been at the center of much controversy in America. The huge turnout has resulted in long lines and waits of up to 11 hours to cast a ballot. Interestingly, it has been reported that registered Democrats have sent in nearly double the amount of votes registered Republicans have. Of these numbers, women and African Americans have been voting at a much higher rate than in previous elections. Many Republicans have refused to partake in mail-in voting as they believe it is a fraudulent process. Trump has been documented on several occasions claiming that the November election will be rigged due to the mail-in voting, a claim that few experts have backed. Finally, speaking on Donald Trump, the president is under fire after his new planned golf course in Scotland was approved. Trump plans on building the course in an area of Scotland known as Aberdeenshire, and the council planners of the area have officially approved construction, to the horror of many environmental activists. The controversy surrounding this comes from the environmental damage that construction of the golf course could bring to the area, which already has an extremely fragile ecosystem. And that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. Goodbye.